Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen, across the airwaves. I really love this show each and every Thursday, The Throwdown. It's a Doc Talk podcast hosted by a brother, a mentor, and a friend. I need that tremendously. He's been that to me. I can go to him for anything. I just love this guy. Dr. Greg Roscoe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Yours truly, Mark Mancini in Los Angeles. Right now it looks like Los Angeles, but over the weekend it could look like Seattle with the rain. And that'll be a story from a meteorologist friend on KTLA Channel 5, Kirk Hawkins. Till then, we'll worry about that another time. 347-205-9631 gets you to the front of the line. Anything after that, blogtalkradio.com/ Mancini Sports Podcast Platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcast powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, more of him, less of me. Let me lay the red carpet, minus the Grammys, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic. Doc, the threes, how are you? How can people get a hold of you? And you're bringing another legend through your great show.
Well, thank you very much for that intro, Mark, and you're absolutely correct. I'm doing well. The show's doing well. We get an awful lot of emails, and I thank you, listeners, for, of course, listening. People can get a hold of me, gjrmd308@outlook.com. Tonight, we really have a very special guest. We have a very difficult topic tonight, and the doctor that we have is Dr. Tuesday Stainbrook. She is board certified in internal medicine as well as infectious disease. I believe she has a master's in public health, and she's been working in this field for probably in about 20 years overall. She's working currently on hepatitis C, and we're going to talk about it and what it's all about, why she's doing it, and what is going on with this. What do we need to know about hepatitis C? So I'd like to bring on Dr. Tuesday Stainbrook. Tuesday, thank you for being with us on this Thursday night. And go ahead, Tuesday. Tell us about hepatitis C.
All right. Thank you again for asking me. I mean, it's a pleasure to be able to express how much my passion is for hepatitis C and getting people treated. So thank you again for asking me to be on the show.
Yeah. Thank you, ma'am.
Yeah. Well, so hepatitis C, I'm sure a lot of people don't realize how common it is. Over 2.5 million people in the United States have hepatitis C. It's actually the most common blood-borne virus. And it used to be recently the most number one reason for liver transplant. Now, steatosis or fatty liver is catching up and is probably, I think, over the last year is winning because, as we all know, we eat well in the United States.
Yes, ma'am.
But hepatitis C is still one of the leading causes of liver transplant and liver cancers in the United States. So that's why it's so important, because it is so easy to treat and get rid of this virus that everyone should know and get tested. Definitely.
Wow. And Tuesday, if we would start just very simply for our listeners, you know, if I can just go to basics, which we like to do, the liver is a large organ in the right upper quadrant of our belly. And Tuesday, it weighs about 20 pounds, 25 pounds, correct? It's a large organ.
It is.
And it is, yes. And, you know, Tuesday, something that you mentioned, I think you said several times now, you know, with regard to this treatment and this organ doing well with treatment, it is one of the only organs we have that has the ability to regenerate if it is damaged, correct?
Oh, that's correct. I mean, that is. It's if someone used to drink and they stopped drinking, your liver can get better. If you have hepatitis C and you get treated, your liver can get better. So it's not too late to ever get treatment. And it's been fascinating to see that people who have actually been on the liver transplant list and they got treated, they can come off the liver transplant list. So liver is an amazing organ. But what people don't realize is Hep C not only can affect your liver, but can affect many other parts of your body. It can cause an arthritis. It can cause a rash. there's a lot of other symptoms that hepatitis C can get. I'll tell you, most people don't have any symptoms of hepatitis C, though. Most people don't even know they have it.
And, you know, Tuesday, we talk about, in general on this show, about the four pillars of medicine. And just to elaborate a little bit, when we see our patients, we talk about history, past medical history. That seems pillar one. And then we go to pillar two, which is our examination. Pillar three is diagnostic testing. Pillar four is decision making. So, Tuesday, if someone comes in to see you, what are they going to say? You know, what are the symptoms that they would have that they'd want to see a specialist like you to help them? You know, is it jaundice? Is it pain? What's the why here?
So most people don't have any symptoms of hepatitis C. But if you're going to have a symptom of hepatitis C, it's these three symptoms: fatigue or tiredness, and just feeling like you just don't feel well, or
sure.
You could have pain in your liver and your right upper quadrant that comes and goes, or just some nausea. Otherwise, people don't have any symptoms of hepatitis C. Now, the symptoms you were talking about, like jaundice and stuff and pain all the time, that's usually a symptom of advanced liver disease. So nowadays, we see mostly younger people, and they don't have the advanced liver disease, but there are people out there that have not been treated yet that may have those symptoms of jaundice or pain.
Sure. Which is it, Tuesday, are those symptoms a little bit more, down the line, so to speak? I mean, I think, years ago, Tuesday, we always thought about, alcoholics as having liver disease, correct? Leading to cirrhosis. Are we on that same path today, or is it more, IV drug users? Is it more bad transfusions? How does all this start?
Yeah, I'd like to go over the risk factors for hepatitis C.
Love to.
The biggest risk factor used to be baby boomers, those born between 1945 and 1965. That is still a risk factor, but most of those people have been treated before already. The most common risk factor we see now is IV drug use. I mean, as we've seen, as the opioid overdose has increased, so is Hep C. And that's why in the United States, we can't get below that 2.5, 2.4 million mark, because people are getting reinfected as we treat them. Other risk factors though, that people should be aware of, though, is if you get a unsterilized tattoo from a friend that had Hep C and they reuse a needle, so any reusing needle or any exchange of blood, sexual contact for Hep C transmission is pretty low, but it does exist. And if you had a blood transfusion before 1992, that's also a risk. And healthcare being a risk, being on dialysis or a healthcare worker who gets, a needle stick. But the biggest one nowadays is definitely IV drug use. That's why we're seeing this surge in pregnancy and people who have are pregnant have Hep C. And then if they don't get treated while they're pregnant, then we're going to see all these children have Hep C in the near future.
Wow. So that, as far as IV drug users, who are these people? Where are they getting these damn IVs for drugs? I mean, is it something they're getting in clinics or in some back room? Where in the hell does this go on?
I think it goes on everywhere. I mean, drug use is pretty prevalent, and we see a lot. I mean, 40% of people who have IV drug use or even have Hep C. But I also want to say it's not just IV drug use that can do it. It can be snorting drugs is a risk factor for Hep C, because your nose and mucosal is so thin
permeable.
And full of I guess you would know that being an ENT.
that lining is very permeable, and again, can absorb that. And again, we see nasal infections. You're absolutely right. And, if you go down the line here, tattoos, what does someone need to know about getting a tattoo? Tattoos are very prevalent today throughout our society. And,
yeah.
You know, are tattoo parlors regulated by the health department? Or how do our listeners know that they're going to get a good tattoo, or maybe they ought to be very cautious?
Most tattoo parlors are doing it correctly. They use new needles for everybody. And the biggest thing that what was linked in the past was they weren't using individual ink wells. So they were like just taking the ink from the bottles. Yeah, and just dipping it. And then if someone had Hep C, they were putting the Hep C in the bottle. But now you want to make sure your tattoo parlor is using individual ink wells.
Got it. And, you know, Tuesday, just along that line, if someone were, in a sense, to get contaminated with a needle at a parlor, Tuesday, how long would it take for symptoms to show? Is there a curve here that says, my God, within 7 days they're going to have a problem, or does it take longer to incubate? What seems to be that cycle?
Well, most people don't have any symptoms of hepatitis C, even acute hepatitis C. And the good thing is there are times sometimes when you can fight that virus and not even have chronic hepatitis C, but about 85% who are exposed are going to go on and have hepatitis C, and you're not going to have any symptoms. If you do have acute jaundice or you do get sick with some nausea, vomiting, that's actually a good sign. That means your body actually saw that virus and is trying to fight it, and you have a higher chance of clearing that virus. But most of the times, if you're exposed, you're not going to know you were exposed. That's why we also have seen in the past there have been Hep C's been spread by medical equipment that has not been sterilized properly.
Wow. And is that medicine or medical equipment for injection, that type of thing?
No. Colonoscopies has been the biggest one. If the colonoscopy, the endoscopy equipment wasn't sterilized correctly, there's been several case reports of hospitals having to go back and tell people, hey, we found out that we weren't sterilizing it correctly and you could be exposed to hepatitis C and HIV.
Wow. That's scary, isn't it?
Yeah. For that reason, the CDC recommends everyone over the age of 18 gets tested for hepatitis C once in their lifetime. So you should have one test once in your lifetime, because there's many people who don't even know how they got hepatitis C. It's not always about IV drug use. So that is the recommendation. And then if you have risk factors, you get tested more than once.
Got it. And Tuesday, we'll get into treatment. I still like talking about this causation. Tuesday, if we talk about sexual transmission, is there any preponderance in, say, a homosexual community as opposed to heterosexual? Is there any differences there, or is it a minor transmission via?
It's a minor transmission. I mean, there is definitely some probably increased risk, but it's minor.
Minor
it's
there.
Not
All right.
like hepatitis A, where you do have an increased, much more increased risk.
Got it. And, you know, Tuesday, you mentioned blood transfusion before 1992. Just for our listeners, what happened in 1992?
Prior to 1992, we didn't know what hepatitis C was. It actually quite wasn't identified, and we didn't know. I mean, I'm not that old. I don't consider myself that old, but I remember when I was residency, it was non-A, non-B. We didn't even know what it was, so we weren't screening for hepatitis C before 1992.
Wow. And, you know, Tuesday, just along that same line, how many types of hepatitis are there? I know you're talking, you know, about C and B. I mean, where are we in the alphabet here? You know, how many types
of hepatitis are there? I believe we're on G. But in the United States, in the United States, though, we are only concerned somewhat of three types, hepatitis A, B, and C. A, you get from contaminated food and water, so it's fecal oral transmission. B is, again, another blood-borne, you know, you have to get it from blood to blood. So those are the ones that we're concerned about in the United States.
Got it. And you mentioned another one. You know, as far as transmission, that being dialysis. What is that, a high frequency place to get hepatitis C? You know, are they very cautious in these units not to spread hep C? What seems to be the why with the dialysis?
Just because you're exposed a lot to blood, and if you're good nephrologist, you should be checking people for hepatitis B, C prior to starting dialysis.
Sure. Got it. And, you know, so we have this setting that Tuesday potentially we all could be exposed to it and maybe even have it, but overall don't have a lot of symptoms other than, you know, your mention about the fatigue, you know, tiredness, things like that. You know, do you find hepatitis C in the general population? Is it more in a nursing home population? You know, where is the sweet spot for hepatitis C in our society?
Well, 10 years ago, it used to be baby boomers, but now it is much younger people between around, you know, in their 20s, early 30s with the drug use.
The drugs. Wow.
Yeah. It definitely is now, the drug use.
And, Tuesday, are we educating our young people about this? You know, are there programs or foundations or, you know, organizations that want to educate young people to the risks of this drug there, of this hepatitis C because of IVs? You know, are we not educating people?
I think we're probably, I mean, yeah, that should be the same conversation you're having with them when they're in middle school about the use of drugs. I mean,
sure,
it should be all harm reduction, but if that's happening, I don't think it's being successful, definitely.
Sure. And now, Tuesday, you know, you've received several awards as well for your work with hepatitis C, correct?
Yes. I've been doing it for quite some time, trying to get the screening and make other physicians aware that they should be screening people, and do a lot of outreach to go to different facilities and do screening there.
And, Tuesday, that would mean that overall, you know, the screening is just a blood sample. Is that correct?
Yeah, the screening we do is just a finger prick that you get your results in 20 minutes. And that is just an antibody, which an antibody is a memory cell. So that doesn't tell you if you have chronic hepatitis C. That just means you've been exposed to it. So then if that antibody is positive, then we do have to do blood work.
Got it. So that overall, the testing is just showing if the body has been exposed and then has reacted against that antigen, correct?
That is correct.
And, you know, Tuesday, once we know this, you know, what are the indications for treatment? You know, who needs to be treated?
That's a good question. And the answer is everybody who has chronic hepatitis C. The only reason not to treat is if someone's life expectancy is less than 6 months. We now treat.
Wow.
Continuing IV drug use. We will treat if someone's still drinking. If you have chronic hepatitis C, the treatment is indicated for everybody. Even if you have symptoms of acute hepatitis C, it's actually indicated also because we can prevent it and get rid of it very easily.
And, you know, you've been using the vocabulary, you know, acute hepatitis, chronic hepatitis. Is there a big difference in the meaning of those words with this disease?
Not really, because it all means that there's virus in your bloodstream. And so any virus in your bloodstream of any hepatitis C virus should be treated. So in terms of treatment, there is no difference.
As far as someone comes into your clinic and you find that they do have been exposed to the hepatitis C, and do you then say, fine and dandy, we are going to start treatment now? Do we wait a month? You know, what is the treatment at this point if someone does have, you know, hepatitis C?
Treatment now is actually very easy. All we need is a little bit more blood work for the insurance companies, and we can usually get their treatment, their medicine started within 3 to 5 days.
Got it. Is this oral?
A very easy
oral
process.
Medication?
Yeah. So the newer medication are pills. The ones that we use most are Epclusa, which is one pill a day for 12 weeks. And the other one that is used, and you can choose either, is Mavrit.
Sure.
And it's three pills with a little bit of food for 8 weeks. Both of these medications have cure rates of 99%. It's amazing.
Wow.
It's not like people who have Hep C, and they may have had Hep C before and are hesitant to get treatment because the old treatments were terrible. They made people sick. It was like a chemotherapy, and it was just bad, and it wasn't very successful. But with these oral medication, they're actually direct-acting antivirals, and they're preventing replication of the virus, and they work so well. The other old stuff, the interferon stuff, was just an immune modulator or something that helps your immune system fight that virus, and it didn't work very well.
Got it. And, you know, Tuesday, if we talk about the area of disease, where is the disease in the liver? Is it at the cellular level? Is that where these viruses are? Is it in the circulation? Where is the disease? So, where does the therapy work? Do you understand what I mean?
Yes.
Where is the problem?
So I call hepatitis C a stupid virus. That's why we can cure it. It is actually living in the cytoplasm of the cells. So we can actually stop the virus from replicating. In contrast to like hepatitis B, it's a little bit smarter. HIV are a little bit smarter. They're actually getting into the DNA and stuff. They're DNA virus.
Uh-huh.
This is an RNA virus that is kind of stupid because it's just hanging out in the cytoplasm and easy to treat and kill.
Beautiful. And, you know, with regard to, you mentioned this is a lengthy treatment, you know, 8 weeks, three pills a day, et cetera. When we go ahead at the end of that regime, Tuesday, do you do any analysis on the success of what you've done? Are you able to go ahead and to say, hey, I have a 99% cure here, X, Y, and Z? Are you able to do that? Are you able then to monitor this person to see if there's a recurrence? Is that something one would need to do?
Yes. So these newer medications, since they're so effective and they're so well tolerated, they don't require any labs while on treatment. But we usually get at the end of their treatment, we usually check to see if the virus is gone. If the virus is gone, a cure is considered getting and checking for that virus 3 months after they finish treatment. So once you finish treatment, 3 months later you get a lab, and if the lab shows no virus, then you're cured.
And let's talk about this as well. You know, so we're saying that, bingo, we've eliminated it. Tell me about symptomology. Indeed, we've eliminated the virus. Are the symptoms that resolved? The fatigue is gone. The patient is feeling healthier. Is there a correlation to that, Tuesday?
Oh, yes. People tend to feel better even on the medicine because you no longer have that viremia, where you never have that virus in your blood that you're constantly, your body's trying to fight. So it's gone. So you kind of feel better. And I do see a lot of people, once they finish their treatment, they have less joint pains, or they feel less, they have more energy.
Sure. And so that you've won a lot, a big battle. And, you know, Tuesday, along those same lines, pregnancy. You know, you're able to treat a pregnant female. Is that correct?
Yes. There is a study ongoing at the McGee Hospital, and they are treating pregnant women. It is not an indication yet, but it is being researched, and it looks like it's going to be very safe to treat pregnant women.
Wonderful. Does the fetus get involved with the viremia also? Is that does happen then also if the mother has Hep C?
Well, the transmission rate from pregnant women to the fetus is about isn't much. It's about 5 to 10%, but it's,
oh, wow.
It's dependent on many things, like how high their virus is, and if there's any at time of birth, if they mix the blood with the mother's blood. That's why if you have hepatitis C, you're not supposed to use scalp leads, so that would make the babies bleed or something. So you don't want to mix the blood. And then also, they can breastfeed, but if your nipples were to be cracked or something, stop breastfeeding, because that would be you would have blood, and you could give that baby Hep C then.
So that's a very specialized part of this whole disease entity and treatment, correct?
Yes. I mean, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, along those same lines, people talk about, vaccination for Hep C. You know, is that in the works here as well? Is that something that, is a lot of BS? Are you able to vaccinate against Hep C?
No. We have not been able to get a vaccination for Hep C. I don't believe that we're anywhere near it, because now we can cure it with the medications and we can eradicate it through herd immunity. But why can we not get a vaccine? Because it multiplies and it mutates so much that they can't, and it's sitting there in the cytoplasm and it's hard to get.
Got
it. It mutates so much. So, no, I don't believe there may be still people looking for vaccines, but it's not coming out soon. It's hopeful just that we'll get so many people treated that if we can't pass it on to somebody else.
Got it. So, overall, you're winning the war with treatment that, again, the other battle, vaccination, may not be of an importance at this point, because you're able to treat it so successfully and your patients do so well.
Exactly.
That's wonderful. And Tuesday,
yeah.
If we talk about treatment, who pays for the treatment? Is this something insurance carriers pay for, or are people paying out of pocket for this?
No, insurance carriers are paying for it. It is very well paid for by a medical assistant.
Will
have no co-pays. And if you have a commercial insurance, there are co-pay cards from the pharmaceutical companies, so there's usually no out-of-pockets, and it's also covered by Medicare and Medicare plans.
Boy, that's super. That's a real win, for our patient population, not to have such long, a long course of treatment. That's super. And, right now, Tuesday, would like to go to the studio in L.A., we have Mr. Mancini there. Tuesday, we have a lot of people that have questions. Would you mind taking a few questions for us?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Good. Mr. Mancini, would you like to give us a couple of questions?
Yeah, I'd like to bring them out to the first. Doug coming in from Tulsa, Oklahoma, first-time listener, says, does hepatitis go away?
Yes. Hepatitis C can be cured with medication, 99%, and your body can sometimes fight hepatitis C on its own. What gets confusing, though, is that you make an antibody, which, remember, an antibody is a memory cell to hepatitis C. So you'll always have that antibody. That doesn't mean you have chronic hepatitis C or virus present.
Got it. So that if we were to do a blood test on that antibody a year after treatment, the antibody is present, but the virus probably is not.
That is correct. And a lot that confuses a lot of people, including a lot of physicians. So that's why I try to educate my patients that get treated. You educate your physician, you always have that antibody. That's your memory cell.
Got it. And it's very similar, if I can just add a point. When we talk about we as ear, nose, and throat doctors feel a lot of strep. And there's something called an ASO titer. If one has been exposed to strep, they have an ASO titer that can be elevated. ASO stands for anti-streptolysin O. That's the membrane on the strep bacteria. So even as an adult, even though you haven't had strep, you still have that ASO titer. on testing. I think it's a very similar antigenic and antibody response. Don't you think, Tuesday?
I agree. I believe ASO titers are pretty much useless when it comes to,
sure,
adults and stuff. Agree.
You're absolutely right. But it's still that memory, though, I think, is making
exactly
that analogy overall. Good. Thank you. Go ahead, Mark.
Okay, let me take two more. One of them is coming out of our Corvallis, Oregon. He's an avid listener. Steve says, well, which hepatitis is not curable?
Hepatitis B. Hepatitis B is not curable at this time. You have to take medicine the rest of your life. Now, it's easy medicine, doesn't have much side effects, it's once a day, but hepatitis B is the one that's not curable.
What about A?
A is usually self-limiting. That's the one you get from contaminated food and water. You get sick, you get better, you got an antibody or a memory cell for life.
Got it.
All right, go ahead, Mark.
I'll give you one more. Robert from Poway is an avid listener, and he says, is hepatitis more or less the inflammation of the liver?
Yes. Yeah, there are many reasons for have hepatitis, which is inflammation of the liver. And we're just talking about there's, like, alcoholic hepatitis, there's, fatty liver hepatitis. But, yeah, they just named these viruses hepatitis A, B, and C because they were not very original when they came up with it.
Got it. Go ahead, Mark.
One more, and I'll get it back over to you because we're getting kind of loaded here. Robin from Warren, Ohio, talks about the term fatty liver, greasy foods, and everything. How serious is having a fatty liver, and how much does that play into with the hepatitis?
That's a great
question.
Yeah. Great question, because it does play into it. It would make you – there's different stages of liver fibrosis or liver stages. Like Dr. Roscoe said, there's liver cirrhosis. That's the last stage. When you have a fatty liver, that makes you progress faster to cirrhosis.
So, again, Tuesday will be very similar if one had, like, an alcoholic problem or an alcoholic hepatitis, correct? The liver
is
damaged,
correct,
and it would take longer to potentially heal.
Well, it won't take longer to heal because of our great drugs they have now, but it will make you progress faster to liver cirrhosis. And one thing that I want to mention real quickly is hepatitis C, just like hepatitis B, can cause liver cancer, and that's why we're trying to treat, and even if you have end-stage liver disease or that liver cirrhosis, even if you get treated, you still need to follow up with your doctor and make sure you don't get cancer that by ultrasounds and blood work.
Oh, very good. And, as far as I have a question that came across my email, what is the correlation with mushroom picking and hepatitis? Tuesday, are there certain occupations that may lead to hepatitis? And, some people, she says mushroom picking, and her husband worked around vinyl chloride. Is that a problem?
I think the mushroom picking is maybe something with related to hepatitis A. I would say fecal oral. I don't
sure.
know. It's not related to hepatitis B, no.
Got it. And, Mark, do you have anything else? Is Mark still there? Tuesday, are you still there?
I'm still here.
I'm still here, too. Maybe Mark got shut off. Tuesday, with, say, ongoing with regard to our young people and IV drug use, if we could get that to decline, that would have a big impact on Hep C, correct?
That is correct, because one person with hepatitis C who's using drugs is expected to infect 20 people in the first 3 years. So
and that's
one person
through
is expecting
IV
20.
Drug use also?
Yes. Or snorting, yes.
Or snorting.
So they can infect up to 20 people in the first 3 years.
times how many people write. And then
yeah.
how about those 20 people? How many can
exactly.
they infect? So it's something that definitely is increasing. And Tuesday, is there any part of the country that is more prone to this than other parts of the country in the United States?
Not really. I mean, it's all have to do with the drug use and how bad your drug use is in your area. I mean, Pennsylvania, we're up there. But, I mean,
yes.
but we also have and, a very, we've been very thankful for Medicaid for really being you know, forward thinking and getting it us giving us our treatment and everything and being paying for the treatment. I mean, I applaud
so
the
overall,
medical
they,
assistance. Yeah, they're
yeah,
great.
Yeah, so, I mean, they were very sensitive to the needs of those patients that they're willing to cover the cost of treatment for them.
Exactly.
And, you know, Tuesday, as far as I think you had mentioned early on when we were talking about IV drug users, that we can do therapy even if the drug user is still doing IV drugs. Is that what we said?
Yes, yes. Now, there is always a chance that you can be reinfected because there are different types of hepatitis C, and you can get reinfected with a different type of hepatitis C. Doesn't matter what type you have anymore, no, but you can get reinfected. So we try to, you know, tell people, you know,
sure.
you really need to use clean needles and clean cookers and stuff and not use other share other people's stuff. You know, one thing I forgot to mention is you can also get hepatitis C from sharing razors and toothbrushes.
Wow. Like in your own home.
Yes, in your own home. If you're rooming with someone who has Hep C, yes, you should
yeah.
not share the razor or toothbrushes because you can get
yeah.
it.
Wow. And would it have to have some contamination with blood cells? Would that be
well,
the...
Right. You know, people shaving their legs or their face, they often
sure.
bleed. And so there's a little bit of blood on that razor and someone else uses it. They also
got
bleed
it.
A bit, and there you have an infection.
Wow. And, you know, Tuesday, as far as health, the healthier our organism, you know, as far as with good nutrition, as far as saying stay away from, you know, drugs, alcohol, exercising, you know, getting enough sleep, you tend to be strong and tend to be able to fight these types of maladies off. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that.
And, you know, as far as a message, you know, to our listeners, that overall, you need to take care of your organism. You know, you get one, and again, we've used the word house for our organism on prior shows, that overall, you have to take care of your house. You get one body. So that overall, you want to take care of it. You don't want to go ahead and use the IV drugs, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You want to keep this organism healthy so that it performs well for you and you have a good life. And can you agree with that as well?
I totally agree with that.
Wonderful. And, you know, Tuesday, we mentioned about cancer of the liver and then about liver transplants. You know, as far as the liver transplant situation, is there a rate of Hep C vulnerability in a liver transplant, or is there very little data on that overall for hepatitis C acquisition?
Well, that's a good question. Now with the new antivirals, they will transplant a hepatitis C liver in a non-hepatitis C person. Why?
Wow.
Because it's, once they hit the transplant, they can treat them with very good drugs that will have 99% cure. So it's sad that of all the overdoses, but because of the overdoses and they mostly being young people, a lot of people have gotten their liver. They've gotten new livers.
Wow. And I mean, that's given them another lease on life. So it is something
right.
that, you know, my God, you got to be very thankful for that overall.
But, yeah,
and
they used to not transplant that, hepatitis C-infected livers. But
sure.
now, or they would only transplant it to someone who had a hepatitis C fail already, and then they, but now they will transplant a positive Hep C liver into someone without it.
And so that tells us, with regard to medicine today, medicine continually is getting better and making us healthier and giving us more options for care, correct?
Yes. That, I mean, it's been great to see the evolution of hepatitis C since I've been doing this for so long, where, you know, it was so difficult, and now it's just so easy. It's definitely
wonderful.
The time to get treated.
Yes, and, you know, I had another email coming in Tuesday from Clearwater, Florida, and our listener there says, what exactly is an infectious disease expert? Would you mind elaborating on that?
Yeah. So I did an internal medicine residency. And, like, so there's different residencies, like surgical residency
school?
Or family. Yep, I went to medical school. Then I went and did a residency. I did an accelerated residency internship, and so I did 3 years. And then I went and did a fellowship in infectious disease. I did that at the University of Pittsburgh. And at the same time, I got my Master's of Public Health at the University of Pittsburgh and continued my education just doing, you know, on and on.
Sure.
But that's what an infectious disease is. It's a fellowship that is done in usually a tertiary care center.
It's a lot of years of study. And, Tuesday, what does it encompass? What would be the scope of, you know, infectious disease? You know, what does one in infectious disease do?
Well, I have a pretty large range of patients. I'll see people with Lyme disease. I'll see people with bone infections, lung infections, infections anywhere. I'll see, you know, just basically infections. I also see, you know, HIV patients. We also now provide PrEP, which is pre-exposure to prevent. There's now great medicines that prevent HIV, and there's even injectables for that too. So, I mean, any kind of infection I see.
You know what? Could you elaborate a little bit on COVID? I know it's a big topic.
I mean, I think that we're not seeing the deaths like we used to. You know, there's the vaccines that.
Yes.
If you're elderly and at risk, you should definitely continue getting the vaccines. Or immune system is not good, you should get the vaccine. Also, what I think is being underutilized today when it comes to COVID is if someone gets COVID and they're at risk for it to be severe or the symptoms are bad,
surely,
per se,
there's
a great medicine out there. Yeah, there's a great medicine out there, Paxlovid, that actually helps get them better faster. I mean, I don't know why more people don't use it. It's no different than Tamiflu for the flu. So I do think that nowadays what we aren't seeing as many COVIDs, but if I do have a patient who does, you know, is that immunocompromised or at risk for complications, I still prescribe the antiviral to help them get better faster and not feel as bad.
Wow. And, you know, is the rate of people getting COVID, is that on a decline at this point because of vaccination or our knowledge about it? Where are we with COVID today? You know,
well, I think it's multifactorial. I mean, a lot of people don't get tested today, so it's also the decline on that reason. We're not having to report it as much. It's on the decline. But, I mean, we aren't seeing it as much in the community either, or we do see it, and it's a mild disease. So it's hard to say how many people actually get COVID compared to 2 years ago, but, you know, I would say it's definitely on the decline, but the numbers aren't really representative of true infections.
Yeah, and I think you're correct also with regard to people dying from COVID. I think those numbers have gone down.
Definitely.
And, you know, several years ago, the hospital was full of people dying with respiratory ailments from COVID, et cetera. So it is something, I think, would you say we're getting a handle on it? The vaccines are helping. What do you think is the winner here? you know, what happened that we started to win the battle?
Oh, I think what we started to win the battle was the vaccine. I think that we started to try to get to that herd immunity, and then it definitely helped a lot.
And
then I think everyone getting I was just going to say that also I think that people have had COVID now 1 to 4 times, you know, most people. And so also you're also developing antibodies among, you know, everybody else has got the antibodies. So we probably do have a great herd immunity now that I think about it, because I don't know anyone who's never had COVID.
Right, exactly right. It's touched a lot of people.
Right.
And do you still see patients with COVID in your practice? Are they coming to see a specialist like you about that? Or are family doctors handling it?
I think family doctors. I can't say I've had any referrals for COVID. The long-term COVID symptomatology, you know, they're still studying it. I don't think there's anything much to do for it. There are people who unfortunately have sequela of having COVID. That's not new. I see all the time people having Lyme disease and having sequela and the post-Lyme syndrome. So it is basically something that a virus started something in your body and you have this autoimmune reaction and now you can't stop it.
No, I got it. And Tuesday, you know, in your scope of practice, are you doing IV administration of drugs and things like that to help your patients? Are you able to do that in your practice, these they need, even though maybe they're not oral, they're more intravenous? Has that changed your practice?
Yeah, I do. I do have an infusion center, and yeah, it has changed my practice. We have a lot of great new antibiotics that are weekly, and so that prevents people from hospitalization. So, yeah, it definitely has been a great asset to my practice to have an infusion center right there.
So you're able to treat them without going into a hospital or a clinic hospital or something along those lines. And, you know, we have a few more questions, if you don't mind, Tuesday. Let me get Mr. Mancini.
Yes.
Can you hear me, Mark?
Yeah, I can hear you loud and clear.
Yes, sir. Do you have a
Let me get a couple more as I'm manning the board here. And Dalen from Chelmsford, Mass., another great listener to the show, basically says, with the fatty liver, how long does it take for that to turn into cirrhosis?
Doctor?
Well, it would depend on several factors. You know, their genetics. There's a fatty liver where people don't even have to be overweight and have a fatty liver. Hopefully the new medications, there's going to be new medications coming. It would depend on how much the person drinks, if they got any other diseases. But you're looking anywhere from 10 to 20 years, possibly 30 years. I'm not sure. I cannot tell you exactly how long average is for fatty liver to cause liver cirrhosis. But I do know that it is becoming one of the top reasons for liver transplant now is fatty liver. And then hopefully in the next year or two, we're going to start having some medicines to treat fatty liver.
Wow.
Wonderful. Mark, I have a question here coming across.
Okay.
Tuesday, again, it's a generic one. What is liver ascites? What does that mean?
To have ascites is when you have liver cirrhosis, the end-stage liver disease, and your liver isn't working correctly, and so your protein leaks out into your belly, and so you have big belly, and it's very taut, and it's usually indicated that your liver is at end stage.
And this is fluid that happens in our abdominal cavity, correct?
Correct.
All right. It's a complex issue. It's a symptom, Tuesday, that you would see toward the end of someone with serious liver disease, probably not in the Hep C type disease spectrum, correct?
Well, yeah, we do see it. those patients we send down to the University of Pittsburgh, and we treat them together because there's
okay.
at risk treating decompensated cirrhotics. That would be considered that they don't,
sure.
their body isn't working anymore, so it's decompensated.
And these are sick patients, correct?
Yes, those are sick patients. Yes.
They're sick patients, yep. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, let me get another one coming out. And this one is Victor from Silver Lake. How does apple cider vinegar play into this? Does that clean out your liver? That's a great question, too. I didn't even know that.
I don't do.
Well,
do you know that?
Okay. No, I don't know of any medical evidence that that apple cider helps. I mean, it would be probably considered a vitamin, and you don't need to have any evidence behind these claims. So have I really medically have any evidence that helps? No.
Tuesday, what about nutritional supplements? Do you ever prescribe those for liver disease to help get the liver healthier? Is there you know, any good track record that shows that certain supplements may help build the liver?
So when we had when we had the old medication, and there are some research behind it, I used to recommend milk thistle.
Okay.
Because there are some literature that is pretty old that suggests that milk thistle helps the liver, helps prevent further scar tissue in the liver and stuff. Have I recommended it lately? Not really, because what I'm seeing now is not those baby boomers who are like 55, 60, 65 years of age. I'm seeing these young people who really don't have any liver damage yet because they got it from IV drug use.
Got it. And push, again, I think the key here, the win here, is overall the fact you have such excellent medications and treatment regimes to help cure this. All right? I mean, that's the
beauty.
That
is correct. Mm-hmm.
And no doubt that gives you a lot of power when you're treating your patients to be able to let them know that you can cure what they have with medication. And, you know, the other thing, Tuesday, when your patients are on these regimes for 8 weeks, how do you keep them motivated to continue to take medication? You know, is there a psychology involved with that, or are these people motivated enough that they have a second chance, that they'll do whatever the doctor says?
Well, that's a difficult question because it used to be yes. I would motivate them. We'd check the blood work more, and we'd check and see if their viral load was down at week 4 and week 8, because before the treatments were a whole year pretty much. Now the treatments
wow.
are so short that, and
yes.
there's no need for blood work, that
wow.
other than talking to them, yeah, we do. And these people are young. They have, their lives are quite chaotic sometimes. Sometimes they just don't take it. Or
sure,
they'll take 4 weeks instead of 8. But good thing is, these are good medicines. Sometimes 4 is enough.
Sure. And, you know, once you start treatment, if they fail treatment, so to speak, in doing it, can you restart treatment again and go through the process?
Yes. I mean, if there's a good reason, sometimes the insurance company will be a little upset about it, but usually if we have been able to get them retreated, or if they lost their medicine 2 months ago and everything
yeah.
started it, we can usually get it, yes.
So you may find glitches like that. And, you know, Tuesday, are you working on an article on this hep C? Are you doing research and things like that? I understand,
yeah.
you know, you're doing an awful lot of this, and I think a lot of people have been reaching out to you for information.
Yeah, I mean, we're always working on something. I think we just got a simplified treatment regimen just published. It was just accepted in the Journal of Hepatology and stuff. So, I mean, we do research and stuff, and we do a lot of outreach also.
Excellent. And, you know, plus you're a full-time practitioner as well.
Yes, I work full time. Yes.
No, very good. And just for our audience, your husband is a nephrologist. So he's working full time as well. And, you know, again, do you work together on this project? I know you talked about dialysis and, you know, possibly things happening in the dialysis clinics. Do you help him along that so they keep their process neat and clean?
Yeah, somewhat, yes. I mean, if you are seeing both my husband and I, that's not a good sign. But
okay.
Occasionally our paths cross, and I throw him a bone once in a while, and we help
sure.
each other out.
No, I got it. And it's good to throw the husband the bone and vice versa overall. And Tuesday, how would you want to go ahead at this point? We've had an awful lot of listeners call in. A lot of people are listening to the show. If we would start to summarize Hep C, what would you want to tell our audience? You know, again, where does it come from? What are the symptoms? What can we do about it to help them? You want to summarize it for us?
Sure. Hepatitis C is a very common virus that many people don't even know that they have, and there is very little, if any, symptoms. So the current recommendation is that everyone gets a hepatitis C test at least once in their lifetime. And if they have risk factors such as IV drug use or living with someone with Hep C or, they share someone's toothbrush and accidentally, then they should get tested again. And the good news is, though, treatment is easy. Cure rates are 99%, very short duration to treatment. We can treat even three-year-olds.
Wow.
The medication's indicated to, yes. And, and there's no hardly side effects. And it's a very non-invasive treatment. And so if anyone's thinking about getting Hep C tested, they should and offer treatment. We actually have a website that people can connect directly with us. It's www.telehep.com. So it's www.telehep, TELEHEP.com.
Would you want to give them a phone number also?
Sure. The phone number is 814-371-2348. But the easiest way to get a hold of us is through the website.
Website, yep.
Yep, because there's a little widget there. And that little widget goes directly to us, and you hit that little widget, and we can contact you. We treat people in Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia,
wow.
Let me think. Indiana and Tennessee.
Yeah. So really in a multiple state area, you're well known.
So we can do all that treatment because the treatment's so easy. We do a lot of telemedicine when it comes to treatment.
Sure. And wow. Wendy, Tuesday, are you going ahead? Are you doing any more publishing or writing any chapters in any books and things like that with what you've been doing?
We're constantly just working on things. But yeah, I mean, I can, I don't know if you can list it there. I think it's just a lot of stuff.
You're doing an awful lot.
And I didn't prepare, and I'm not the ones that can just rattle off what I've done.
Yeah, I got it. I know you do a lot. I think our listeners loved it. You're very well educated. And Mark, I think we're going to wrap this up tonight.
Yeah, as we wrap this up, I know next week you're going to be bringing another great guest on your show. I can't wait to hear about that. We get that thing promoted across the social media platforms. Doc, let everybody know how they can get a hold of you as we wrap this thing up and put a bow on it.
Beautiful.
All right.
Go ahead. Wendy, Tuesday, thank you very much. And my web is gjrmd308@outlook.com. And just briefly, next Thursday, we're having a head and neck cancer surgeon that is a specialist in skull-based tumors. And the ENT now has spread to doing craniofacial work. And I've got an excellent surgeon from the Cleveland Clinic to talk about skull base surgery and reconstruction. Mark, he's a big deal. Should be a great show like tonight.
Wow. For the docs in Pittsburgh, yours truly, Mark Mancini in Los Angeles. Catch the archive version, blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports. We'll see you next week, same time, same channel. Till then, have a blessed and safe weekend. Good night, everybody.
Thank you, listeners. Thank you, Tuesday.
Thank you.